Hey, this is Kumar.
Hey, it's Graham.
And this is episode 3 of the Pelletcast. Welcome.
Woo!
All right, guys, today's episode is brought to you by Audible, audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/almighty. You have over 180,000 titles to choose from, and they can go on your iPhone, your Android, your Kindle, whatever your e-reading device is, Audible is on it. So make sure to check it out. Shout out to them for sponsoring this podcast. Cool.
Word.
So, Graham, what do we have in store today?
So, I guess it's been a little over a week since our last podcast, and as we both anticipated, the Pelicans are no better or worse in the playoff hunt. They have gone 2-2 over the last two games, four games. A loss against Washington, then a win against Phoenix, then a loss against Utah, and a win against Minnesota. Now that Washington loss, Kumar, was right after the Detroit loss, which you said was the most depressing moment of the season for you. Well, that Washington game, the Pelicans blew it in the fourth quarter, scoring 8 points to the Wizards 25. Was that like a second blow to you, where you didn't think you could go lower, but you sank lower? Because that's what it felt like to me.
No, I was numb at that point. I was very much numb. They didn't score the last 6 minutes, I believe, right?
Yeah, didn't score for 6 minutes.
Six whole minutes.
So they were winning 91-90, and then
couldn't buy a bucket.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no comment on that.
It's really weird because they had this horrible, horrible collapse. Right after a horrible, horrible collapse. And then they won against Phoenix in some ho-hum game, like who cares. And then they almost an equally embarrassing loss to Utah, where they, I don't remember if it was wire to wire. I think it was wire to wire. They were just straight up dominated. And I think even the team was numb. They didn't seem upset afterwards. They were just like, wow, Utah's really good. That was the reaction after the game.
That was really weird. So it's one thing for Gentry to say it, but it's another, like, that was the feeling around the team.
That was just the general mood was, wow.
And even, like, I was at that game. I managed to get tickets, and I actually won a free King Cake Baby shirt. It was great. I scared people with it. It's going to my collection of items that I'm going to wear during Mardi Gras this season. But I was at the game, and I was watching, and they just did not seem interested. I think the first half, maybe Davis had 4 points. He wasn't doing his thing. Drew was trying to do his stuff. Drew was playing well. Terrence Jones somehow was effective that game. But as a whole, the team just was not interested at all. They just seemed like, hey, they didn't want to run hard. They kept on coughing the ball up. They kept on fouling. Like, it was, and they just, like, Utah ran them off their own floor. Utah was dominant in that game.
Yeah. Can't really say much more than that. It was pretty bad. Yeah. I think there was, I can't remember what it was, but there was like a, it was the, I can't remember which coach it was, but they asked him about the, they asked him about the loss, and they said there's a bunch of these quotes where it's just like, yeah, when you turn the ball over 20 times, you probably aren't going to win. And then, like, another one said, yep, when you don't score for 5 minutes in a row, you're probably not going to win. And everybody was just like, yep, like, you're probably not going to win if you just suck at basketball.
If the other team scores more points than you, you're going to have a bad time.
You give up 127 points while only scoring around 100, you're probably not going to win. It was really awkward. It was really weird. It was a really weird game. And then they turn around, of course, and have a fantastic game against Minnesota.
Which Anthony Davis gets up for, of course.
Yeah, vintage Pelicans. Davis has got to be up for that to keep himself on the pinnacle of young big men.
The OG unicorn.
The OG unicorn.
To remind every GM that participated in the survey this summer that, hey, I'm the guy to build around.
I've seen that one survey updated every. They update it all the time. It's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. I think I saw it in like the span of 4 months. I saw four different versions of it, where it was originally Anthony Davis, then it was Cat, then it was Embiid, and then it was like back to Davis. And it's, what GMs are participating in these surveys?
The one they do annually in the summer, all of them do, I believe.
Hmm.
Yeah. But,
no.
Yep. But AD got up for that game, you know, 42 points, 13 rebounds. Towns had himself a game, too. For unlike the previous game, AD didn't spend much time defending Towns. I believe, you know, that's to just conserve his body, not get into foul trouble, all of that. But it was interesting that they were throwing Dante Cunningham at Towns. And that's...
Yeah, it hurt a lot in that first quarter. Towns had, like, 20 points in the first quarter, and I think at least, like, he had... I think I can remember three where it was just an offensive... They put back an offensive rebounder, a dunk. Just because he would run, you know, Davis would have to challenge a shot, and then he could just overpower Dante to go into the rim. So he killed him early on.
But Towns is a phenomenal talent, so credit to him. But Drew and Buddy also had themselves a game. What do you think about that?
Drew's been killing it lately. I mean, we've talked about that the last couple podcasts. He's just been on fire. But Buddy, probably his best game. Definitely one of, if not hit, you know, the best. I think he had 17 points on 7 of 10 shooting. But, like, there was just like a bunch of good things to take from Buddy for this game. And I'm going to put something up on bourbonstreetshots.com about this. So check later in a day or two for that. But basically we saw, like, all the good things come from like Buddy's, you know, normal hustle, I guess. You know, he's always active on the boards and always pushing it in transition, and like all that stuff seemed to work out for him against Minnesota. So he had all that going in his favor, where he's, you know, rebounding, pushing it down the floor. But the thing that I saw is that he looked more comfortable when he actually got into, you know, the paint inside the arc, right? When he's pushing this ball, when he's pushing these balls up the court, he actually probed into the paint quite a few times, at least in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
Like where he would come in and then kick it back out.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically, in the third quarter, and anybody who can actually just go and rewatch the game, like just go rewatch the third quarter and watch Buddy in this Minnesota game. They basically kept running the same kind of set. And basically it was just like a motion into a Drew and Davis high pick and roll. Like, that's all it was. But Buddy would start with the ball, like, way out on the left wing facing the hoop, like, well out there. And Holiday would take his man down all the way to the baseline and then come up around the key through two screens, first Dante and then Davis, and get the ball from Buddy, you know, with his guy chasing him, and then go into a Drew and Davis high pick and roll with Buddy down on the wing. And we've seen that play before, like with Anderson popping out for three off the Holiday Davis pick and roll. Like, mm-hmm. That's something they do all the time. But Buddy was like extremely dynamic in this role. They ran the play 7 times in the last 7 minutes of the quarter, and they got 13 points out of it, and one turnover from Solomon Hill. But it was awesome. It was great. I think the first time Buddy, and this was good to see again, like he put the ball on the floor instead of just settling for a challenged three. He put the ball on the floor, attacked the closeout, and hit a mid-range shot. Then later on, like they ran it again, and they ran it again later, and Buddy got it again, and he did the same thing. He attacked the closeout. He like dribbled into the paint. He found a lane, kicked it back out to Dante Cunningham, but then he kept moving and repositioned himself on the other wing, and then knocked down a three-pointer. And then, like, on the next play, it was, like, the same thing. And it was just, oh, man, it looked great. Definitely Buddy's best game. Like I said, I'm going to write something about that. But did you see any of that? Did you catch any of this in that game?
Yeah, I did. I managed to watch that game. And Buddy looked great off the ball. He was actively looking to find the back door. In that lent him easy looks at the rim. He was probing, as you mentioned, and he just, it looked like he knew what he was doing, and he wasn't second-guessing himself that game. But
yeah, there's a lot of comfortability.
There was. And
something we haven't seen.
It helped that AD was playing well and Drew was playing well, and he was benefiting from the attention those guys were drawing. However, you know, as good as he looked there, part of me wonders, you know, if it was a product of Minnesota's just terrible, terrible defense. Like, those guys have no clue what they're doing out there.
I was going to say, like, in two of the possessions, you know, because the objective of the set they ran was to get Holiday's guy chasing him. It was Rubio on Holiday. I think in two of the possessions, Rubio, like, either tripped or got caught behind a screen, so Holiday had space to create in the first place. And one of them was, like, Rubio fell down so he could see Buddy wide open under the basket. Mm-hmm. And if Rubio hadn't fallen down, that would. But, yeah, like Minnesota's not the greatest team. But, I mean, what you can take from it is, like, Buddy felt comfortable with the ball in his hands, like, creating in that role. You mm-hmm. know, normally when we saw that high pick and roll with, like, Anderson or Gordon or even Buddy earlier this year, it's specifically they're going to be, you know, a three-point shot by Buddy, or they're going to, like, have to reset the play. Or, right. you know, with Anderson, same thing. Like, either it'll be a three-point shot or
there's going to another screen roll action or something off of that.
Yeah, where they'll have to, like, Holiday will have to come back around or something, or they'll just try to post up Davis. But, like, when they ran this set a couple of times where Buddy was, like, a, like, secondary guy or that guy they kicked it up to, it was a little bit more dynamic, and that's, like, what's encouraging to see is that, you know, there could be a role for him in that offense if he can continue to build out how he can score and create. So, I mean, that's encouraging. But then you see, and for everyone listening, that we're recording this during the Sacramento game, but he just got ejected. So,
oh, buddy.
This is hilarious. This is what I really wanted to talk about, because this just happened a couple minutes ago. Any thoughts? Any thoughts on this Buddy ejection? I'll let you take this one.
So for those of you who haven't seen it, which I'm sure by the time this podcast comes out, you will. Buddy was chasing his guy off of a screen. DeMarcus Cousins was setting a screen. Now, most people, when they chase a guy over the screen, they like take a large step and go around it and then chase their guy. Buddy was running with his arms outstretched. And what he did was he took his right hand and he shoved it in DeMarcus Cousins' groin. Just shoved it right up there, grabbed it, yanked it, rotated around the screen, and obviously DeMarcus Cousins was bent over and complaining to the ref and visibly signaling, hey, this needs to be a technical, this needs to be a technical. The refs review it, send it to Secaucus, New Jersey, in case you didn't know where the NBA headquarters were, Secaucus, New Jersey. And eventually they reached the conclusion that this is a flagrant 2, and Buddy gets ejected from the game. It was the most bizarre sequence of events I have seen in a long time regarding the Pelicans. And I have no idea why Buddy would even be running like that around the screen. Like, I know sometimes when players are on offense and what they do is they like to slingshot around players that are setting screens for them in order to create more separation between them and the guy chasing them. But Buddy was on defense, so I'm not sure why he was trying to slingshot around DeMarcus and why he hooked his arm into his crotch. Yeah. It just made no sense. No sense whatsoever. But Buddy's gone for the rest of the game. I think he had 5 points before he was ejected, so it looked like it was going to be a decent or an okay Buddy game. But the world would never know.
Buddy could have been about to take off. This could be like the turning point in Buddy's progression.
Oh, Alvin Gentry was not having it. He had to, like, the other assistant coaches were holding him back. Like, Gentry had already gotten a technical at this point, and Gentry was...
He got a technical like 2 minutes into the game.
Yeah, and he was just not having it. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do see Gentry get ejected at the end of this game, or by the end of this game. It'll not be surprising, but...
Not happy at all.
I wonder if AD's going to, like, pay Buddy's fine.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I wonder what the fine's going to be. Over under on 15,000.
Oh, he's a rookie. Don't they have like a first offense rule?
Do they?
Or something?
I do not know the rules.
I don't know. Maybe I might be making that up completely. I don't know. It looks bad. It's like hard to. You can't really look at it and defend it. You just look at it. I tried to look at it and be like, well. But there's nothing there. There's nothing. You can't. What are you doing?
It warranted an ejection. I have no idea what the ensuing fine will be, but we'll see, I guess. We'll see.
That's a good number to put on it.
15,000? That's harsh for a rookie. Yeah.
It is.
He's making like $5 million a year. Who am I to complain?
Yeah, he's on one of those nice lottery salaries.
Yeah. Guaranteed money. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Welcome back. So we have a lot to talk about. Pelicans have been involved in a lot of trade rumors, particularly regarding Sixers big man Jahlil Okafor. But before we do that, Graham's got some history for me. Graham.
History segment. Woo!
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. Today, if you did not know, is February 12th. That is the day we are recording this podcast. Maybe not the day you are listening to it. But in this day in Pelicans Hornets history, there were three players to score 25 or more points. All these players are pre-Anthony Davis era Pelicans. Sorry, Hornets. Pre-Anthony Davis era Hornets. Can you, Kumar, guess which three pre-Anthony Davis Hornets scored 25 or more points on this date?
Let's see. Was one of them Christopher Paul?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's obvious.
All right. Okay. Is the second one David West?
Yeah, that one's obvious, too.
All right. Okay, so I figured those two would be a given. Now, after this is a complete crapshoot. My heart says Peja, but I'm going to say Jannero Pargo.
Okay. Is that your final answer?
Jannero Pargo, final answer.
Okay, that's stupid. It was Peja.
Damn it.
You blew it. No, okay. David West and Peja Stojakovic scored 27 points, while Chris Paul scored 25 points. All in the same game, the 12th of February 2008, 100-86 win versus Chicago. This was the 2008 Hornets that won 56 games lost in
Derek
the second round.
Oh, no, Derrick Rose wasn't playing at that time.
No.
No, never mind.
But that was an interesting game because I looked at the Chicago roster and holy crap.
Who was on that roster?
Like, wow, exactly. You want me to start reading names?
Who
like,
was the coach? Was it Del Negro? Who was the coach?
Who was coaching the Bulls?
Yeah.
I don't even know. Let me look. Do they have it like the recap here? Recap. Chris Paul. David West. Does it just not say somewhere? It's got to say like somewhere. Give me just, I want to know. Well, anyway, but listen to some of these players. Maybe it's in the Fox score. Listen to some of these players. Joe Smith. All this crap in Wallace. Andreas Nocioni. Cephalosha.
Cephalosha got a start there. I forgot he was even on the Bulls. I thought he was like OKC all day.
Mm. Jeez, some of these. Well. Tyrus Thomas, Aaron Gray. Aaron Gray was on the Chicago Bulls, played 12 minutes that night. Joakim Noah. So Aaron Gray, Joakim Noah, that's a nice little front court duo there, I guess. Kirk Heinrich was still there. Chris Duhon. They just didn't have him. There's no one on this team.
I feel like Kirk Heinrich could die on the Bulls floor and I wouldn't even blink. Like, he's been on that team. I think he retired now, did he? I don't know where he's at, but I feel like Heinrich's been on the Bulls for like 80 years.
He's been there forever. At least that's what it feels like. Andres Nocioni scored 28 points against us, though.
Kirk Heinrich was 28 years old that season. That's crazy.
He's so freaking old. Is he still playing? He's not still playing.
Right? That was like seven. That was 7 years ago.
Hold on. Now I have to check on that. This is. Kirk, he can't still play. He's got to be retired. I'm gonna look this up.
Maybe like medical retirement. Tibbs ran into the ground, man. Oh, he played in Atlanta.
He played last season.
In Atlanta.
He played half the season in Chicago and half the season. He only played 11 games for Atlanta.
Okay.
So I guess he's done. He didn't play this year.
Good old Kirk Heinrich.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting game. That game also, Tyson Chandler had 16 rebounds. Just as a side note. But anyway, more on Pelicans Hornets February 12th history. There's one player in the history of the Pelicans Hornets to shoot 100% from the field with more than one field goal attempt.
No way. Is it Aaron Gray? No, wait, hold on. Is it DJ Mamby?
And this is not just to say, it is a Davis-era player.
Oh, it's a Davis-era player?
Yes. So this one, only player to shoot 100% from the field with more than one field goal attempt on this date in Pelicans Hornets history.
Jason Smith.
Davis-era player. Alexis Ajinsa.
No.
7-7 on the 12th of February 2014 against Milwaukee. A win. He had 16 points and 9 rebounds.
How many fouls?
Two.
Two fouls?
Two fouls in 22 minutes.
Somebody should sign that guy to a long-term deal. They should sign him. They should lock him up.
Stop saying things. Anyway.
Speaking of Ajinsa. He is rumored to be involved in a trade.
Yes. A trade that could or probably won't, or who knows, do like change anything for this team. Probably won't. Sounds like a salary dump. If you haven't heard, it'll be either Alexis Ajinsa or Omer Asik plus some kind of pick. We don't know what year or protection. I assume that's what the argument is over.
Preliminary reports are saying that it's the 2018 pick, and they're haggling over the protection. Nola wants lottery protection. Obviously, Philly wants as much as it can get. But yeah. The framework is there. It's pick plus one of our deadweight centers for the much-troubled and maligned Jahlil Okafor. Many who have written about and consider... A lot of people are starting to include him in bus talks, which I think is frankly ridiculous. But his numbers...
He's still pretty young.
He's really young. He's 20 years old, I think 21 this year maybe. I have to check his age. Yeah. But he's really young. He's god-awful on defense. His on-off numbers in advanced on-off, like RPM stuff, it's not pretty in any sense. But... Hey, he can score. He has some fancy.
Yeah, if you watch him, he's got skill.
Yeah, he can definitely move. He dances like a ballerina sometimes, and it's a welcome change from our plodding centers. What do you think? What are your thoughts on this deal?
I mean, it depends. It just depends on the pick. Like, I don't care about Okafor. Like, it's a young, cost controlled player for dead weight. You know, it's like an asset reshuffling, if that's what they're doing. And, like, I'm totally fine with it. Asik and Ajinsa are just dead weight at this point. So, obviously, they want to clear them off the books if they could. Now, Ajinsa's only somewhere around, like, $5 million a year. So, I mean, they better be putting some good protection on a pick just to dump that. You know, if it's Asik, then we're talking a little bit loose on the protection. But... Like, Ajinsa's not really owed that much money.
No, I think he's maybe 2 years left on his contract.
Yeah. They need something in the front court. If they, you know, for in general, just this year, next year. So I understand reshuffling here.
So last time we were on this pod, we did talk about adding a big. We talked about particularly adding a defensive big. Now, the players the Pelicans have been linked to this past week are Brooke Lopez, Jahlil Okafor, obviously. There's minor talks that the Pelicans have asked about Vucevic and Nurkic, who just got traded today. So none of those are defensive bigs, but they are big bodies. All of them can do stuff in the post. And all of them are young, except for Brooke Lopez, I suppose. There seems to be a theme in what kind of players the Pelicans are looking at. Now, I believe you've written something about this. What do you think this says about the Pelicans?
I mean, I don't like it, but I guess I understand it. If I'm just looking at like the product on the court or kind of building continuity off like what they've been trying to be building, or if I'm looking at like stuff like that, they need a defensive big man. They don't have one straight up outside of Davis, who is also tasked with carrying. And so they need one. I mean, whatever. But I mean, if they're gonna like Jahlil Okafor move is different than Brooke Lopez or Vucevic move, but investing in someone like Vucevic and Brooke Lopez is like a move away from the defensive end. You know, like they had this whole mantra this whole offseason, this whole year about building up the defense, and like bringing in Etuan Moore and Solomon Hill fixes the defense all of a sudden. They're just going to stop working on it. They're talking about a process. It doesn't just go away after 1 year. It's not like 1 year, oh, okay, we fixed it, everything's fixed. So I don't like that they're looking for like some kind of offensive center that randomly. No, I hate it. All right, hot take. Screw this. I don't like it one bit.
Is it really a hot take? I feel like the overwhelming response to, like, when you hear Jahlil Okafor mentioned, people are like, damn, you're trading away our picks for terrible players and mortgaging our future and getting in players that go against Alvin Gentry's system and all of that. So is it really a hot take?
No, I think, like, a well-protected pick and, like, dumping Ashik or Jensen for Okafor is a good move, but, like, not Brooke Lopez.
Here's a hot take. I would love to trade for Okafor. I say do it. I say if the pick is top 10 protected, do it right now. Stop haggling. You're not going to get lottery protection. Dump Ajinsa. Pull the trigger. Shoot. I'd say I put top 3 protection. No, okay. I'm not going to go that hot take. That's too hot of a take.
Did you say top 3?
No. That's too hot of a take. Top 10. I do top 10. Easy. Here's why. I think... So we obviously know what Okafor's flaws are. He struggles to defend any and everything. He is looked at as an offensive black hole who gets the ball in the post. You often won't see the ball in another player's hand. It's like a bigger version of Terrence Jones, you know, if you think about it. Isn't looked at as a great passer. Those are very, very obvious flaws. Also, there's concerns about his maturity, where he got into a bar fight in Boston. He was caught speeding across the bridge in Philadelphia. So there are some emotional concerns that come with him. But here's what I like about him. His rookie year, he basically put up 18-7 on pretty decent efficiency. It was like 54%, 53% true shooting. You're shooting over 50% from the field. On a team that was built to lose. This team was just flat-out incompetent. They won 9 games. They did not have NBA-level players around him. He was the only offensive threat, and their whole system was, hey, Okafor, do something. And they paired him with perhaps the worst complementary front-court partner, and that was Nerlens Noel. Both centers, both don't space the floor, both don't offer much off the ball. It was a horrible, horrible situation for him, yet he put up some nice-looking stats. And people were like, Philadelphia was I think, what, 10 points were worse per 100 when he was on the floor. But, like, that was their net rating all season long anyway. Like, they were just a bad team. They won nine games. Like, I don't know what you're expecting to see in his plus-minus stats. Like, I don't get it. But when you look at his stats after Ish Smith was brought in, so Philadelphia gave up 2 second-round picks to bring in Ish Smith. They bring in Ish Smith, and Okafor played 422 minutes, I believe, with Ish Smith, and like 218 without him after the trade. In those 420-so-whatever minutes that Okafor played with Ish Smith, the closest thing to an NBA-level point guard the Sixers have had in years, no disrespect to TJ McConnell, who's been playing really well this season, the closest thing that they've had to a point guard in years, Okafor shot 60% from the floor in minutes he shared with Ish Smith. 60% from the floor. Like, that's pretty talented. Now, if he was on the Pelicans, they would have a young, cost-controlled big. He would have 2 years left on his rookie contract, right? He would be playing a much, much reduced offensive role. He wouldn't be the focal point of the offense. Your offense would go through Drew and AD, and obviously Buddy would be spacing the floor. Okafor would be at best a third option, but what they're asking Okafor to do is, you know, be able to catch the ball. Ashik can't catch the ball. Be able to dunk the ball. Ashik can't dunk the ball. That kind of stuff. And let's say, you know, you do run some plays that give him the ball in the post. Opponent teams are faced with the option, do we double team Okafor and leave one of Davis, leave one of Holiday, or leave whoever? Or do we let him go one-on-one against our guy? And Okafor's pretty solid one-on-one. Like, that's a legitimate sacrifice you make as a team when you make that decision, if you choose single coverage on Okafor. So I think if you put him in a much better situation, now obviously this is the optimist speaking in me, but I think if you put him in a much better situation, you reduce his role, you put him around NBA-level players, not just that, you put him around Anthony Davis and Drew Holiday, you begin to see a much different player. Now obviously the concern is on the defensive end, where you sacrifice everything you've built this season. You've built a small switching scheme that forces turnovers, that is able to switch on bigs, smalls, whatever they want, they are effective. With Okafor, you kind of throw that away. That is a pretty big concern. I think they would have to shift up the scheme. They would have to mimic kind of what Charlotte did with Al Jefferson the last few years, right? They had him play a very conservative drop down on the pick and roll sag, the ice type defense, where he would kind of plot in the paint and guards would be forced into mid-range shots. And basically you would be taking away the role man by kind of like hanging out in the paint. I think anytime Okafor is involved in a pick and roll, that's the type of defense you got to play. But I think, you know, maybe you could still be effective switching everything else except for whatever Okafor is involved in. And I think Okafor, we kind of saw this problem when we had Ryan Anderson, who was, as hard as he tried, inept at defending anything in the pick and roll. But Okafor at least has much better tools. He has a 7'5 wingspan. He has a much better block rate. He can actually block some shots. So I think, you know, you have him hang back, draw back a little, let him use his size, and that might be able to deter a few shots. I don't think the defense will be pretty. I think it can be not horrible. It would require a lot of buy-in, and it would probably take a season or two. But I think it can work.
So you don't have to sell me on like his fit on the court. I would like the move just from like an asset reshuffling type of standpoint. You know, depending on the protection on the pick.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. But you know, I'm just not so sure about how, you know, the small ball or the switchy type of defense that we've kind of gotten or employed this year. You know, he doesn't have to start. How much do you have to buy him? Right now, our front court consists of Anthony Davis, Donatas Mateunas, Terrence Jones, and Dante Cunningham. Right? Like, it's not... Yeah, there's just room for minutes. You know, the front court depth's not there. Cunningham plays power forward like 30, 40 minutes a game. You know, Okafor could come in and play 10 to 15. He could come in and play 20 to 25. But I don't think it's going to change too much of what we do in like clutch situations, or, you know, I think it'll still be that small ball lineup in there. I don't think Okafor is going to come in and make, and all of a sudden we're going to have to change our defensive scheme around Okafor. I think they'll try to fit him in, you know, because if, you know, if it is like a scheme shift thing, with the roster, it'll still, they're still going to try to work him into what they're trying to do. So I don't think they'll like switch it.
Yeah, you're right. We see Monta Ioannis out on the island by himself all the time. So why not Okafor? Yeah, I don't think that they're going to end up changing their scheme this season. You're probably right about that. But I do think if Okafor is in the plan long term, if he's going to start next to AD, they might look into adjusting. Because I do believe that bringing in a guy like Okafor or any of the guys that they've been rumored to be interested in, it sends a message that AD does not want to play center. Now, AD himself has sent that message loud and clear through public and private interviews. So that's obviously not an issue. But I think if they do bring in Okafor, he's going to end up starting. And while he might not close the game, you might see him for 30 minutes a night. And I think that's the plan, is to get a long-term starting candidate next to AD. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the plan, too. I'm just not sure, even if they do move for Okafor, that guy is Okafor. But we'll see.
You see the Bulls are interested in Okafor. I cannot imagine them. What are they going to do with Okafor?
I think that's just one of those teams they just, like, threw out there. Like, you know, they throw a name out. Like, an agent will throw a name out there, or somebody will throw a name out there. Like, oh, look, another team's interested just to...
I saw something today that was like... Yeah, be watchful of Portland, who just traded for Nurkic. They are still interested in Okafor and want to maybe pair him. And I'm like, what? No, they don't. That's agent speak at its finest. God, Portland has enough defensive issues. They don't want to add Okafor.
Yeah, they were trying to. That's what makes trade season just annoying. Because you can tell which ones kind of make sense and which don't. But then when they just like float this stupid ones out there that kind of just get floated around for no reason. Yeah. But I enjoy this time of year.
I do. The trade deadline is my birthday this year. So hopefully the Pelicans give me an awesome present. But knowing them, they'll find a way to ruin it.
Would an Okafor deal be a good birthday present for you?
Sure. It would be. And then I'd find out they give up the 2017 unprotected pick, and I'd be like, no, this is terrible.
God. I don't know.
That's okay.
I think the most disappointing thing for me is if they just didn't do anything.
I think it's almost a safe bet. This 2018 pick is going to be gone. Just gone by the end of this deadline.
I think it is too.
I think they want to do that, and that way they will be able to trade the 2017 on draft night. They could be like, ha ha ha, we traded two picks in a row. Saipin will be damned.
No.
You know it's Don't coming. You know it's coming.
Stop talking. I don't want to hear this. It's not. We're going to get the number 3 pick, and it's going to be fine.
And they're going to trade it for Evan Fournier.
I like Evan.
For the 3rd pick. I don't.
Yeah, let's just add another shooting guard. Let's just do that.
We're going to make him play small forward.
Oh, God.
No. Okay, well, I'm gonna stop talking. I'm going to take your advice. I think that's all we have for today. Hopefully they make a move between now and the next podcast so we can talk about that. And hopefully they choose to take...
You've deflated my hopes now, is what you've done.
I think that is par for the course with this franchise. You should have deflated hopes. If they make this trade, whatever they make this trade, I genuinely hope they commit to pawning off Galloway, Cunningham, whatever, these guys that are on the edge for whatever they can get, any type of assets, and lose more games than they win, or they lose a lot more games than they'll win for the close out, to close out the season, so we can get a decent draft pick, even if they do end up trading it. I think it helps us. I think a good draft pick will help us, regardless of whether that player will play in a Pelicans uniform or it'll be used to acquire a young vet. And I think Okafor will help with the tanking, so that'll be great.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're already on to looking towards next season.
Towards next season.
New Orleans.
Hey, we can do a draft podcast and talk about all the guys that we might draft but will never play for the Pelicans. It'll be a great podcast.
Jesus. Fine. That's time. Pelicast. Definitely not a draft podcast.
Okay. Well, yeah, no. I think that's it for tonight's Pelicast. Thanks for listening, guys.